Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people.
Richard Heinberg is one of the world's foremost peak oil experts, and he's a research fellow of the Post Carbon Institute. He's the author of 8 books, including The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World, and The Oil Depletion Protocol. Also, his new book, which I haven't had a chance to get to yet, but we're probably going to get a chance to talk about it today, is Peak Everything.
Yes, good to be with you, Michael.
It's great to be with you, too, and thank you for your work. I was just saying earlier that you've been all over the planet here this last year. How many lectures have you done in the last year? Do you have any idea?
Actually, I don't have an accurate count. My guess is in 2007 it was something like 50 to 75.
My, wow. Well, thank you for the great work you're doing. And I think most of the people that listen to this show have some sense of peak oil, but let's just start at the beginning. What is peak oil?
Sure. Well, because oil is a finite resource, it's a non-renewable resource, there's only so much of it out there. And the oil age started well over 100 years ago, and we've found all of the easiest and best plays in the world, places like Texas and Oklahoma and Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico and the Middle East, all of these places where oil was easy to find in plentiful amounts. Those places have been tapped and in many cases have pretty much run dry. The U.S., of course, was the world's foremost oil-producing nation for many decades in the 20th century. And the U.S. oil production peaked. It reached its maximum and started to decline back in 1970. Prior to that time, there were many years when the U.S. was not only the world's foremost oil-producing nation, but the world's foremost oil-exporting nation.
Yeah.
And, of course, today we're by far the world's foremost oil-importing country, and we're seeing nation after nation go through exactly the same experience. The North Sea oil, which came online in the 1970s, is now declining. Mexico's oil production that the U.S. has been relying on for the past years is now declining. Indonesia, the list goes on and on. Most oil-producing countries are now seeing declines in production. When that happens for the world as a whole, as everyone agrees it will, it's going to be an entirely new economic moment for planet Earth, because we won't be able to rely on more and more cheap oil to fuel economic growth. And so we, as a society, who have become overwhelmingly dependent on oil for transportation, for agriculture, and so on, we're going to have to make other plans. We're going to have to figure out how to run our economies on something other than oil. Now, that's easily said, but in practice, it's going to be very challenging, and especially in a situation where this is forced upon us by nature. It's not just a situation of deciding one day, well, oil is a little troublesome for environmental reasons, and so let's just switch to something else. It's not going to be that easy, because the something else has yet to present itself. We don't have good substitutes for petroleum, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit more during the hour.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I was looking at Jeff Brown's export land model the other day, and even I didn't quite grasp how quickly the depletion is happening. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the signs are that global production of regular crude oil reached a maximum in May 2005, and we haven't caught up to that yet. So that suggests that this global peak of oil production is not something theoretical in the far distant future. It's probably already happened or is in the process of happening right now. Now, the rate of decline once we reach the peak is a subject, obviously, of considerable interest. And if you just look at the total amount of oil that the world produces, that decline is likely to be pretty small on an annual basis for the first few years at least, and it'll gradually pick up speed to maybe 2-3 4% a year by 2020 or 2025, something like that. Now, that's pretty sizable, but it's, you know, it's possible to imagine economies somehow getting used to having less oil every year and, you know, making much more fuel-efficient vehicles and so on. What you're talking about with Jeffrey Brown's export model is a new wrinkle in this whole equation, which has to do with the fact that oil exporting countries are also oil consuming countries.
Exactly.
And in all of those oil exporting countries, like Saudi Arabia and Iran and Brazil and so on, those countries are also oil consuming nations, and oil consumption is increasing in those countries. So the amount available for export is going to decline much faster.
As the global standard of living is increasing in those areas.
Right. We're already seeing this in Russia, by the way.
Yes.
Russia has accounted for most of non-OPEC oil production increases over the past number of years. And even though Russia's total oil production is still increasing, its exports have actually started to decline over the last couple of years.
Right. I think that one thing that's also hard for people to understand is that once you hit that peak point, and maybe you could talk a little bit about this, the oil that you're getting is not quite as easy to get on a diminishing scale.
Right. Well, it becomes much more expensive to get, and we're seeing that too. Costs of oil production have more than doubled in the last 7 years. And that's one of the reasons for the increase in oil prices, but it's not the main one. The main cause is simply the fact that demand is increasing, but supply isn't. One reason for the increase in costs of production, as you say, is simply the fact that we're having to look in more and more obscure places for oil, usually in deep or ultra-deep water, where it's very expensive to operate. And another problem is that the oil industry has a shortage of trained personnel and equipment. Oil drilling rigs are in short supply, and during the 1980s and 1990s, when oil prices were very low, there wasn't much incentive for people to go into technical fields like becoming oil production engineers or petroleum geologists. So as a result of that, now there's the situation where there just aren't enough of these highly trained people to go around, and the ones who are still working at it are mostly in their upper 50s and early 60s, nearing retirement age. So there's a big question in the industry as to who is going to be finding all of this new oil that the world is going to need.
But because of the way they use computers, they've pretty much found there hasn't been any big oil fields found for a long time.
Well, there have been some headlines recently about big oil strikes in ultra-deep water off the coast of Brazil.
And also the North Sea.
And, well, the North Sea, there are still discoveries going on there, but much smaller ones.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, there was a bit of a press kerfuffle about a find in the Gulf of Mexico, Jack II. These are things that wouldn't even have shown up on the radar screen 30 or 40 years ago,
right.
Back when we were finding really giant oil fields like Ghawar in Saudi Arabia or Cantarell in the Gulf of Mexico. Fields of the size that we're making such a fuss over now would have hardly raised an eyebrow. But now that discoveries are becoming so few and far between, you know, if somebody finds a 5 billion barrel oil field, it makes the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Right. It's hard for people to really grasp what we're talking about in terms of the impact on us. I read somewhere that one barrel of oil equaled the energy source of 12 people for a year.
Well,
I don't know if that's an accurate figure,
but
I remember reading that going, oh my God.
Think of it this way. Actually, it's far, far more than that. If you think of it this way, if you have to push your car for a few feet off to the side of the highway, maybe you've run out of gas, you know, and you have to get out and push, that's a lot of hard work. Imagine pushing your car 30 miles. How long would it actually take you to do that? Well, in fact, it would take you weeks of back-breaking work. And that's what we're getting from a single gallon of gasoline. We're getting the equivalent of, in fact, several months of human labor from a single gallon of gasoline that we're currently paying $3 for.
Right.
Now, imagine if you could get, you know, say, 3 months of labor for $3. You can't get that labor that cheap anywhere on planet Earth. certainly not in China or Indonesia or any place like that. So that's why we have mechanized every possible activity over the last 200 years. It's cheaper to get machines to do it as long as the energy source is as cheap as oil is currently. There's no way labor can replace that kind of mechanization.
It's really a paradox that we seem to all be working harder, two people instead of one person in a family. You know, people are stressed out, working long hours. I used to be a corporate consultant,
right,
and did that for 25 years, and just people being burned out. And yet we have all this extra energy. What are some of your thoughts about what's going to happen and the impact of this? And just work, before we talk about environment or anything else, just in the area of work.
Well, obviously, as the cost of energy rises, and in fact, it's not just a matter of the price of oil gradually rising. You know, we're paying $3 a gallon today, and maybe, you know, in 5 years we'll be paying $6 or $7 a gallon, and we'll gradually adjust. That's not a realistic view of what we're talking about. We're much more likely to see extreme price volatility, so that we, in fact, the price of oil could go to several hundred dollars per barrel. But on top of that, we're likely to see absolute shortages,
mm-hmm.
such that, you know, there will come a day when you pull up to the gas station and the tanks are dry.
We had that already in the 70s.
We had that in the 70s, and that was temporary due
right.
to a political situation. The OPEC countries of the Middle East were withholding oil from the U.S. for political reasons. In this instance, it's not going to be temporary. It'll be a permanent situation, and it will be getting worse with every passing month and every passing year. And we're already seeing situations somewhat like that in other parts of the world. Obviously, with oil at $100 a barrel, those who can afford to pay $100 a barrel are the ones who are getting the oil, and those who can't afford to pay aren't getting it. And in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, Zimbabwe, I was just in New Zealand a few weeks ago and met someone who had just returned to New Zealand from Zimbabwe, and he had photographs of the gas lines there that are, in some cases, up to 4 days long. In other words, you get in line to buy gasoline and you wait 4 days to get your gas.
Wow.
And of course, you know, people who are wealthier are hiring others to wait in line for them. But can you imagine the economic impact of that, the slowdown in transportation, not only of people, but also of goods? What happens to grocery stores if the truckers can't get their diesel fuel to get the food to the grocery stores? Typical supermarket has about 3 days' supply worth of food, and it's relying on those trucks to show up every night to replenish the shelves.
That brings up another subject that I learned from you a number of years ago, was the idea of supermarkets versus service stations or gas stations.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about this whole biofuels, ethanol kind of thing, and the impact and the relationship to what's on our table and food in the oil picture.
Sure. Well, a year ago or so, everyone was singing the praises of ethanol and biofuels. Here was a way to grow our own fuel, to reduce our reliance on foreign sources of oil, and also to give a little subsidy to our American farmers who haven't been doing all that well in recent years. So politicians were in favor of it. The environmental community was in favor of ethanol. It was hard to find anyone saying anything negative about ethanol. Well, what a difference a year has made.
Mm-hmm.
Now, alarms are being raised in many sectors about biofuels and corn ethanol in particular, and for a number of reasons. But the central one is simply the fact that as we use ethanol to power cars, we're essentially taking food out of the mouths of poor people.
Yeah.
We're starting to price food according to the price of gasoline. As the price of gasoline and oil goes up, that creates more incentive for the farmers to sell their crop not to the food industry, but to the fuel industry. And the amount of fuel that can be made, even if we were to turn all crops in the U.S., not only the corn crop, but soybeans and you name it, everything that can be turned into biofuel, if we were to turn it all into biofuel, it wouldn't even come close to supplying our gasoline and diesel needs.
Now, is that about 25% of the world market? Is that how much we consume?
Yes, that's right. The U.S. Is about 25% of the world market.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's amazing. I want to stick with this food thing a while because the average supermarket has maybe 3 days and in a crisis probably 3 hours worth of food. And when you can't get it, and our average food travels, from what I understand, something like 1,500 miles.
That's right.
That's a lot of, not to mention the agribusiness. And I love the story of Cuba, what happened there when they got cut off. Do you want to talk about that whole area of the food? And yeah, thank you.
Right. Well, when we think of oil, we think of transportation. And transportation is the largest single use of oil. But second to that is agriculture. And of course, agriculture is pretty important because we all need to eat. Well, we've created over the last 100 years or so an agricultural system that's overwhelmingly dependent on oil. It used to be that 70-80% of the population was engaged in agricultural production because it takes a lot of work to farm and grow food. But as we were talking about earlier, it's wherever you can mechanize production processes, it pays to do so because of the cheapness of fossil fuels. So, of course, we did that with agriculture. We replaced human labor and animal labor with tractors and other mechanized farm machinery. And it was amazingly effective. Now, today, only a tiny percent of U.S. population works at farming. Less than 1% if you're talking about full-time farmers who get all of their income from farming. And that's, at one level, that's something to be proud of. You know, we've freed up all of these people to do other things. But in the process, we've created a very vulnerable system because now if that fuel supply is threatened, well, what happens to our food supply? We've also used fossil fuels to create fertilizers and chemical pesticides and herbicides. So modern farming on the whole is so dependent on fossil fuels that for every calorie of food energy that we produce, we have to invest about 10 calories of fossil fuel energy. Again, this is an entirely unsustainable system, and that's likely to come back and bite us as prices increase and as actual shortages develop. Now, you asked about Cuba, and it's a really important instance because here was a country that was actually using more fossil fuels per acre in agricultural production.
With monocrops.
With monocrops than the U.S. was back in the 1980s. Cuba was pursuing the old Soviet-style agriculture with giant state-owned farms and big, inefficient Soviet tractors. So they were guzzling down the cheap Soviet oil, which they were getting as a kind of bonus from the USSR. And suddenly, the USSR went bankrupt and collapsed in the late 1980s. And this was an enormous crisis for Cuba, and it was first and foremost a food crisis. So what they did was very quickly adapt their food system to a low fossil fuel regime. And they did that by breaking up the biggest state-owned farms into smaller collectives and privately owned farms, training a lot more people to be farmers because they realized that without the big tractors, they were going to need a lot more people involved in food production. They started breeding oxen. They started growing more food in the cities where the people were so that they didn't have to transport that food over long distances, again, using more fossil fuels. And all of this largely worked. They were able to avoid a famine. Now, it's true that the average Cuban lost about 20 pounds of body weight during this period. It was still a very, very difficult time for the nation.
But they did it in 2 years.
But they were able to do this in quite a short time. And the reason they were able to do it, interestingly, is that they already had a number of organic agronomists at their universities who were trying to push the country in this direction. They were arguing that Cuba was too reliant on fossil fuels. It wasn't good for the land. It wasn't good for the economy and so on. And previously, nobody had been listening to them, but they had formulated a plan for getting Cuba off of fossil fuels in agriculture. And then when the crisis came, these people were called in and said, well, they were given free rein, basically, to redesign the food system, and they did so.
Yeah. The permaculture movement really emerged there. I mean, even though it happened a long time ago in terms of people knowing about it, an example of that. When we talk about how much free time has been freed up for us here in this country, and I think of freed up for what? To watch more television, to answer more emails? Because what it, in effect, has done in a larger perspective is it's removed us from our connection to the earth.
That's right.
Which has probably got something to do with how we can just continue to allow these things, these atrocities to happen. I love that right now Korea in Ecuador, they have Plan Verde going on down there to actually keep the oil in the ground, to keep from destroying the rainforest any more than it's always been. And this is popping up in a lot of different places, this concept.
Right. Well, you bring up an interesting philosophical point there. Is, you know, why is it that we modern industrial humans have been able to just sort of watch as the world is plowed and clear cut and
burned
and mountaintop removed and all the rest of it, and with hardly a protest? Well, as you say, the reason is largely that we have become so disconnected from the natural world. We talked about how 100 years ago, maybe 70-80% of the population was directly involved in food production, or farmers. And today it's 1 or 2%. Well, what's everybody else doing? Well, they're flipping hamburgers. They're working at wherever, banks, offices, sitting in front of computers.
Well, they're also turning the earth into consumer goods, weapons, and waste at an alarmingly increasing rate. In fact, maybe you can talk about rate of consumption.
Yeah. So we have become, instead of being citizens, instead of being persons, we're now consumers. That's how we've been encouraged to identify ourselves, and so we don't notice as the natural world is destroyed because we no longer have much direct contact with it.
You're about my age. You remember when we were called citizens?
Yes, right.
Instead of consumers.
Yeah. Well, this was a deliberate strategy on the part of the advertising industry.
Yeah.
Back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, because at that time the problem was overproduction. With the cheap fossil fuels, it was possible for factories, companies to make far more stuff than there actually was any market for. And part of the cause of the Great Depression was, in fact, the problem of overproduction. So the solution to that was to find ways to encourage people to buy more stuff. And there were several ways of doing that. One, of course, was the advertising industry. Another was planned obsolescence. And another was industrial design, just making stuff look really cool and sexy and making the look of everything change every few years so that, you know, 1 year the cars are kind of smooth and bulbous and streamlined, and 3 or 4 years later they're all kind of hard-edged and wedge-shaped and so on. And if you have a car that's 4 or 5 years old, everyone can immediately see that it's an old car, and you feel a little embarrassed about it, so you have to buy a new one, even if your car still works perfectly well.
And
again, all of this worked like a charm, and we see ourselves now not as citizens but as consumers, and as a result of doing so, we identify ourselves with the health of productive industries that we otherwise might consider adversaries. I mean, rather than seeing employers and corporations as being, you know, plunderers of the earth, we see them as the producers of all the goodies and stuff that we consume, and as our caretakers.
Right. Yeah. That brings up another subject to me, which is ecological genocide and oil wars. You know, we've got Iraq going on. Of course, you know, the party line is it has nothing to do with oil, but it seems like that was the first thing we secured when we went in there. Iran has is one of the big oil producers, one of the big five, I think. But there's places like Darfur that is really the consequence in, you know, what's going on there. People don't realize that actually had oil in its beginning.
Right. Yeah, well, and this is generally true. If you have a country that is not militarily strong and it has natural resources, almost inevitably the people of that country are going to be denied the income from those natural resources, and the country is going to be manipulated by and fought over by the major powers. And so, in fact, if you're a small or poor country, having valuable natural resources is a curse. And we see this out all throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And traditionally, it has been the case in Latin America as well. However, just in recent years, with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and now Ecuador and some other countries, we're seeing
Bolivia.
A backlash against this, and resource nationalism is beginning to take hold. Of course, Vladimir Putin in Russia is probably the most important example of this, because after the end of the Cold War, the U.S. undertook a deliberate policy of bankrupting the old Soviet Union, Russia, and basically destroying its economy under Yeltsin. But Putin is a different kind of character, and he actually wrote his thesis in college on creating a new government in Russia based on resource nationalism, and he's basically followed all of the elements of his thesis.
Interesting. So where do you see Russia going right now?
Well, Russia is becoming more and more important as a supplier of natural gas and oil to Europe and the rest of Asia. And so Russia's geopolitical star is definitely in the ascendancy these days. And geopolitics, for those who've pursued it over the past several hundred years, has always been about control of the Eurasian continent. So Russia, being the largest country in Eurasia, has always had a very important place in geopolitical strategy. Now that Russia is flexing its muscles, in seeing more and more interests in alignment with China, India, Iran, supplying natural gas to Europe, building pipelines to carry gas and oil throughout the Eurasian continent, it inevitably, this will come more and more into conflict with the long-range strategy of the U.S.
How's the China card fit in here now? They're now the second largest importer. Their economy is growing at a startling rate. They're building a new coal plant every week, I think,
right,
on the average. How does that fit into the global picture now?
It's a complicated situation because, of course, China is an economic powerhouse. Its rate of economic growth is just astonishing. But it's also unsustainable because it's based on coal. China is by far the world's foremost coal consumer right now. It has become the world's foremost emitter of carbon dioxide, causing global climate change. But as I say, that's an unsustainable situation. You can't maintain economic growth at that pace for very long when it's based on depleting non-renewable resources like coal and oil. China's coal is running out very quickly. Its coal production in China is probably going to peak within the next 5 or 10 years. Countries already importing coal from other countries like Australia, South Africa, and the U.S. as far as that's concerned. And if China's biggest customer, the United States, goes into a severe economic recession, which seems almost inevitable at this point given the subprime mortgage fiasco.
And then the consumer loans coming due this month.
That's right.
Now.
Well, that could very easily puncture the Chinese bubble economy. And in fact, the Chinese economy, which looks so robust on the surface, is actually a house of cards.
Hmm. Yeah. And we owe, I don't remember the amount, perhaps you know, but just a startling amount of money to China.
Well, yes, China's become a major source of investment to the U.S. and even now buying up part of Citibank as that bank has some serious troubles with its overextension into the mortgage market.
So just to round out this global picture before we talk a little more about what we can do is India. So how does that fit into the big picture?
Well, India, of course, is also a quickly growing economy. India is also a very, very quickly increasing consumer of coal and importer of oil. So it's in some sense competing in that regard with China, but also sharing China's fragility in economic terms for the same reasons. Probably all of our listeners heard the announcement that Tata car company in India had just introduced a new car that costs $2,500 to make car ownership affordable to the masses of the Indian people. Of course, that means as millions of these cars are sold, demand for oil in India will increase dramatically. And all of the problems of traffic and pollution and everything that goes with car ownership and oil consumption will go along with that. So India is desperately trying to emerge as an industrial nation. Most of the population of India still live in rural conditions and are subsistence farmers. The national policy of trying to change that is really a very wrong-headed, catastrophic policy. And in fact, everything should be done in India to support the subsistence farmers, because that's the actual sustainable base of that country's future. And the effort to industrialize India and to urbanize India, to bring more and more people into the huge teeming cities, is going to be absolutely catastrophic in the long run.
Well, there is a growing movement, isn't there, on supporting the small farmers?
Yes, there certainly is a movement there. Vandana Shiva has led that movement for many years. But I have to say, it's a minority movement. The government is pushing very much in the opposite direction.
Richard, the picture, 93% of all of our oil is non-renewable. You've got liquid fuels, natural gas, as well as coal and, you know, uranium. Give us a little idea of the over picture.
Yeah, 93% of our total energy supply is non-renewable. That's right. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, you know, we've been mainly talking about crude oil, not your liquid fuels, not uranium, not the coal. You know, we still have a lot of coal reserves and huge environmental impacts in many ways to if we decide to go that direction, which I'm afraid there's a lot of pushing for that.
Sure.
So bringing it back home to, you know, the United States, what's your prediction on all of these things depleting, the natural gas things that we haven't talked at all about, and which I think, I'm not sure, but most of it comes from Canada, if I'm not mistaken, from the U.S.
Well, actually, no, that's not true. We get about 18% of our natural gas from Canada. Now, Canada is exporting about 60% of its natural gas to the U.S.
Now, that's the number I must have been thinking.
Both countries, both the U.S. and Canada, are teetering on a peak of natural gas production right now. And the decline in production is likely to be much steeper than is the case with the decline of oil once we reach the oil production peak, because gas can be, you know, literally sucked out of the ground.
Right.
And natural gas wells deplete very quickly over short periods of time. The typical new natural gas well in the U.S. is one-third to one-half depleted in the first year.
Hmm.
So we're having to explore and drill for natural gas at record rates just to maintain current rates of production.
Which, of course, the demand is increasing.
And, of course, the demand is increasing. Right. So prices of natural gas have shot up over the past few years and become very volatile. A lot of the chemicals industry, which uses natural gas as a feedstock, we're talking about Dow Chemical and DuPont, have relocated in other countries. They've taken their factories and closed their U.S. factories and relocated to other countries where natural gas is cheaper.
Right.
So we're probably facing a real natural gas crisis in the U.S. over the next few years, and Canada. Nobody has a solution for that. People talk about liquefied natural gas being brought in tankers. And yes, that could be a very partial solution, but there's some problems there. Only a small, very small portion of global natural gas is traded internationally or overseas by way of tankers currently. And most of that trade is already locked up by countries like Japan and South Korea that are big industrial countries and don't have any domestic sources of natural gas. So they already have the long-term contracts. Hmm. And a global natural gas production peak isn't all that far off. We don't have a specific time estimate on that now. It's most likely to happen by about 2020 or 2025, but global statistics on natural gas reserves are even fuzzier than oil statistics, so it's hard to put an exact year on it. But it's not that far off. So natural gas is a big problem. Then there's coal. Everyone assumes that we have 100, 200, 300 years worth of coal because that's what we've all been told. I'm in the process of writing a book on global coal supplies, and doing some research on that, and it's astonishing to see where those statistics actually come from. If you look at how coal reserves are actually determined and measured, it's appalling. Basically, there's a husband and wife team that sends out a letter to every country in the world on a yearly basis and says, how much coal do you have? And based on the replies they get to that letter, they formulate a table of global coal reserves that ends up getting published by the U.S. Department of Energy, the U.S. Geological Survey, the International Energy Agency, BP, and others. And it's taken as gospel. But where do those numbers actually come from? If you go down the list, country after country, there are some countries that actually do geological resource estimates in a responsible manner. And as the coal is removed from the ground, they reduce their reserves and so on. But most of the countries who respond to the survey are basically just, you know, working with a dartboard. They're saying, how much coal would we like to have? What figure can we say that everyone's, you know, not going to laugh us out the door for saying, and they just put that number on it, and the number never changes.
Well, Richard, isn't this also true, though, of global oil resources? I mean, each of the countries in OPEC seems to every year have the same amount of reserves left, no matter how much they take out, and they raise the numbers up.
That's true, and that is true for OPEC. Some other countries like Norway, the United States, have been very responsible in reporting oil reserves, and so these numbers all get mixed together. Mm-hmm. The numbers for, say, Kuwait and Great Britain get mixed together, and everyone assumes they're talking about the same thing, when that's certainly not the case. Reserve figures for Kuwait, for example, are probably over 200% of what could reliably be called real oil reserves. Whereas when we look at oil reserves for Great Britain, this is something that's very carefully audited by public corporations that have to get their numbers right, or they're taken to court.
So basically, we've got a pretty depressing picture here when we look out into the future.
Well, yes, and just to finish up with coal, the most recent studies of coal suggest that we're likely to see a global peak in coal production in something like 20 years, around 2025 to 2030. Now, that's sort of preliminary information, because that's just on the basis of a couple of studies, very good studies, I think, but nevertheless, only a couple of studies so far that have actually gone out and tried to look at those nation-by-nation reserve estimates and pare them down to what actually is believable. But that's an astonishing result. If we've all been told that we have 200 years' worth of coal, and basically there are no resource limits in sight, and then to be told that, in fact, we're facing a global coal production peak within about 20 years, that's an enormous change, and it has implications for, well, obviously for our electrical power grids, which are, in the U.S., overwhelmingly coal-reliant, for the global economy, for the whole discussion about global climate change, on and on.
There's so much more we could cover on this, and we've barely touched the surface, but I wanted to lay out kind of the big picture before we looked at what can we do. You know, conservation is certainly something.
Right.
Only 1% of that 7% of renewable energy is actually wind and solar and those kinds of technologies.
Right.
Where do we go from here? Here we're at this
everything, yes.
Peak everything. But, you know, we haven't even talked about water.
Water, topsoil, minerals, and metals. And of course, all of this is happening quite predictably all at the same time, simply because of population growth and growth in per capita consumption, economic population growth and economic growth. Yeah. Take those two things together and put them in the context of a finite planet, and it's inevitable that we'll really reach peak everything over the course of a fairly narrow time window, namely the 21st century.
Where do we go from
yes.
here, Richard?
Yeah, well, that is something we have to discuss in this hour. And the answer on one level is very simple. On another level, it's very complex. Let's take the simple part first. Clearly, we're not going to be able to substitute our way out of this. We're not going to be able to say, well, it's just a technical problem with, say, oil depletion, so therefore we substitute something else for oil and we keep going our merry way. Because it's not, as we just said, it's not just about oil. It's also about natural gas, about fresh water, about minerals, and so on. So the solution has to be some form of economic contraction. If the problem, in essence, is that there are too many of us using too much too fast, and I think that really is the essence of the problem, mm-hmm. then we're not going to be able to solve that just by running our cars on something other than oil and patting ourselves on the back for being environmentalists as we do so. It's going to take a fundamental change in our entire economic paradigm, in our way of living, in our expectations, in our assumptions about what it is to be alive on planet Earth in the 21st century. And so that's simple to say, but when we look at what that actually means, there are layers upon layers of complexity that fall out from that.
Yes.
So what does that mean for agriculture? What does that mean for how you build and live in a home? What does that mean for work and occupations and jobs? What does that mean for nation states? What does it mean for geopolitics? In each of these areas, you know, we could go on for some time, and there are enormous areas of just unknown implications in all of these fields,
right.
because we've just never been here before. Yes, we did live in stable economies several centuries ago in comparison to what we've known over the last couple of centuries of rapid economic growth. So we know that it's possible to live in steady, stable economies, but we haven't done it for a couple of hundred years, and we certainly haven't tried to do it at the levels of population and consumption that we've grown accustomed to. So transitioning from this hyper-growth economy to a steady state economy where we're living within what the Earth can sustainably provide is going to be the most significant transition in the history of our species.
So the basic things of conservation, of course, are huge.
Yes.
But, you know, one of the things that it's very hard to talk to people, and they'll shake their head and they'll agree and they'll understand and they'll get out and get in their SUV.
Right.
That's one area. But then there's a whole nother area, and that's the widening gap between the rich and the poor. You know, Van Jones has this wonderful Green Jobs program, which I think is just a brilliant thing,
right.
because, you know, if you're barely scraping by, of course you're going to go to Walmart's to buy something that's much cheaper.
Yes.
You know, you're going to do whatever you can. You're not going to buy organic food, and you're probably not going to be driving a Prius or something that comes along like that.
Yeah.
So there's huge inequities that have to be also approached. But from my perspective, we have everything available. It's the examining of the unexamined beliefs and assumptions. How do we change the mindset, the worldview?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the really tough question. It's something that certainly can be done, because we developed this whole mindset, worldview, from scratch over the past couple of hundred years. I mean, go back 100 years even, and nobody had anything like the belief that we have today in perpetual economic growth and consumerism and so on. All of that was manufactured by the PR and advertising industry during the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So if we can create that kind of mindset, we can uncreate it. We can create something else.
Yeah.
And this happened, for example, during the Great Depression. Here was a period when there was a fundamental challenge to our existence as a nation, a fundamental economic challenge. And at first, even Franklin Roosevelt believed that we would somehow be able to solve the problem using normal methods of injecting liquidity into the economy and so on. But by a couple of years into his first term, he realized that none of those usual measures were going to work, and he and his advisors came up with what would come to be known as the economic programs of the 1930s, which basically eventually did turn the nation around, but it required almost undoing some of the basic tenets of capitalism in order to accomplish that.
Right.
I think we're going to be facing a similar, if not much more fundamental, challenge over the next years, perhaps even months, as this subprime mortgage fiasco really starts to, the implications start to ripple throughout the global economy.
Right.
And I'm sure it's going to be a similar situation where at first everyone's going to look to the Federal Reserve and the president and all of these people in charge to come to the rescue with the usual kinds of nostrums. And they're not going to work because we are in new uncharted territory because of oil depletion, because of all of these things we've been talking about. And so sooner or later, we're going to have to start looking at very new and different economic paradigms. Ultimately, we have to create a no-growth economy. We have to figure out how to make an economy work in a situation of controlled, planned economic contraction, where we're actually using less on an annual basis instead of more. It sounds bizarre and scary, but in fact, it's the basics have been worked out by a number of economists in the field called ecological economics, and there are books and textbooks on the subject. It's entirely possible to do, but of course, like those organic Cuban agronomists who were sidelined until the crisis came, the whole field of ecological economics has been sort of sidelined by the economics profession. But in fact, it's exactly what's going to be needed as we go into this economic crisis.
Yeah. One of the things that is a huge deterrent, a couple of them, but one of them is the media itself. And I just so appreciate your being here on Conversations to talk about this, because people can't get this information in the normal mainstream media. It's really a barrier. I'm also wondering, Richard, is this something that can really be handled at a national level, or do we really need to focus on community and our local areas?
Right.
I'd like to think it's both, but I see people, you know, arguing about cap and trade and sequestering and carbon taxes and all these things, and nothing is getting done.
Right.
At that level.
Well, we have to work at the level where things can get done. And currently, there is space at the local and regional level. And there are cities that are taking these problems seriously, like Portland, Oregon. I've been working for the past year with the city of Oakland, California, on the Oakland Peak Oil Task Force to develop a plan for that city. And there are a number of other examples we could cite. Now, I know from working with the city of Oakland that there's only so much you can do. There are some things that Oakland controls that go on within the city limits, and a lot of things that they can't control. They can't force Detroit to produce more fuel-efficient cars, and lots more examples like that. So they can focus on making more public transport infrastructure available within the city, but then, of course, there's the problem of who's going to pay for it.
Right.
And so on. There are lots of roadblocks, but at least there's an openness. There was a willingness of the city council and mayor of Oakland to at least undertake the study and to begin to look at what can be done. That's a lot more openness than we see currently with the U.S. administration and even the U.S. Congress. So we have to work where we can, but I don't think we can afford to abandon any level of government and just say, well, the idiots are in charge, so forget about it, because the fact is there's so much that needs to be done at the national level that if we just, you know, abandon work at that level, then I think we're limiting ourselves in terms of how much we actually can do.
Well, I think some of the things that are exciting are the mayors that have come together to have green cities and some of the smaller communities, like you said, Portland, Willits, and other places that have been doing a great job. And I have to say that Nevada City, Grass Valley, and of course we reach into Sacramento. Sacramento is a little more challenging. There are positive things. Let's talk about what individuals in these last few minutes that we've got, what can the individual do to make a difference, you know, right here in their town, in their community?
Right. There are two levels where individuals can work. One is just in preparation. You, your home, your family, how can you reduce your consumption of energy and your reliance on petroleum? That's not just a matter of, you know, making your conscience feel better and feeling more eco-groovy. It's also a matter of economic survival in the years ahead. So this is something to be taken very, very seriously. I know in my own home, my wife and I have reduced our electricity consumption to less than a third of the California average, and it was easy to do. I think it would be possible to do much more than we have. That's just one example. But the other level beyond that is to look at how you can get involved in your community, because even if you're growing your own food, you have some chickens in your backyard, you're self-sufficient in fruit and nuts and grow a lot of your own veggies and so on, even if you've done all of that, if everyone around you is hungry and you've got a flourishing veggie garden, guess who's going to be ultimately eating out of your veggie garden? So that you've got to be helping to teach other people how to do what you're doing. And that's where the community comes in. If you're living in a community where lots of people are aware of these problems and working on them, you're going to be much better off. You and your family are going to be much better off than if you're just an isolated sort of survivalist holdout.
Yeah, that's beautiful. It sounds to me like we need a reverse agricultural revolution where we're back at 78% to 80% of the people working on their own land or working the land.
Yeah, producing some of our own food. And this can be done even in midst of cities with rooftop gardening, with people gardening in their own kitchens, in fact, growing at least growing sprouts. And, you know, almost anyone could grow something. In the typical American city 100 years ago, something like 50% of fruits and vegetables were being grown within the city limits. And we could do that again.
Hmm. Well, Richard Heinberg, we're running out of time. I want to thank you for all of us for all the work you're doing. And I know you're just a tireless advocate and researcher and educator on this field. And I just feel so fortunate to have you on Conversations. And I know that our listeners feel that way. Thank you, Michael.
It's important that we have media outlets like yours that are getting this information across, because people rely on this, I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we will talk soon, and I will look forward to reading the new book you just put out.
Good.
All right, Richard. Take care. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Conversations is an independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5, Nevada City, and listener contributions. We are committed to bringing you leading-edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at rewelistening.net.